This is a Research in Practice podcast, supporting evidence-informed practice with children and families, young people and adults.
I'm Jill Baller. I work for Somerset Council as a service manager for partnership transformation. And my work with Somerset Council has been a journey which has spanned 12 years, initially starting as the Troubled Families or Supporting Families Programme, as it's now known, coordinator, and realising the need to have one view of a young person. Agencies have many fragmented systems, and those systems hold information on the same child, but often through a different lens. And I realised quite quickly that as we were joining together our systems internally, external partnerships were really lacking the ability to understand more around a child and their family and their circumstances and their associations. So the work that we were doing really with Supporting Family was the lever to our digital transformation, thinking about our data culture and the way we worked, you know, not just as a local authority, but right across our partnerships. I think the biggest piece of work which I do now is around the work with partners and the relationships I have right across the system. And when I talk about partners, I'm talking about the police, I'm talking about Department of Work and Pensions, our voluntary community sector. They play a huge part in the support of the families right across our system. So enabling them to have access to joined up digital view of a child was really important too. I mean, and I'll come on to that later on, but that was obviously some of the challenges that we faced. So our single digital view in Somerset is called Transform Family View. It's built on a Power BI dashboard, so a Microsoft platform. We have a Microsoft Azure data lake, which is in-house within Somerset Council, and our partnership data, which I've worked incredibly hard for the last 10 years, is pulled into the data set, comes in by varying ways, can be through secure file transfer channels, can be a spreadsheet that's automated and uploaded, and from that it gets matched and merged within our data lake and then pushed into our Power BI as our visualization tool. And that Power BI tool has been incredibly helpful because we're able to assign role bases to it. So we, in effect, have one platform which is viewed, but dependent on your role in your organisation is the amount of information that you can see within it.
Building in the single view of the child, it obviously involves a lot of people. So you're bringing together a range of different partners from a range of different organisations to share data, to share children and families information. And that comes with certain challenges. Talk us through how you brought people together and how you overcame some of those challenges as you were developing the dashboard.
Yeah, absolutely. We did come across obviously many challenges. I think the first challenge to think about, and for anybody that's just maybe starting on the journey, is around the information governance and the fact we can, but should we? And that's really important. And the ethics that wrap around this work. So that information governance was one of those big challenges. The other challenge I would say is around that relationship building with your partner. The trust amongst the organisations has to absolutely be there, because even if you have the legal basis, the data protection impact assessment, the data sharing agreements, if the trust isn't there across the two organisations, then that sharing won't happen. And if that sharing doesn't happen, then you're missing big parts of that child and family's life within the system. And having pieces of it missing is almost as important as just not having it at all. It's really important that we understand those gaps and lack of information in some cases. So that partnership building. Now, we were really fortunate in Somerset because I've worked in Somerset for a long time. And historically, I came from the police. So I'd already worked alongside many of these partners and that trust was there. So those relationships were built. Absolutely, really important when you start to work alongside those partners is that you don't just work alongside the colleague that is at the level you're at. You need to be coming in at the top strategically, so there's a strategic buy-in to share that information, and you also need to be including those practitioners who are on the ground working, because they need to have an understanding of how this information is being shared, what they can onwardly share with. So there's two different elements to it. I know that our data protection officer is incredibly busy at the local authority, like many other local authorities. So actually we use some funding from the supporting families to buy in dedicated resource for our information governance work. And the other element, which has been really helpful for us in Somerset, is the Cabinet Office. So we use a piece of legislation to onwardly share called the Digital Economy Act. Well, that power was built in 2017 and is owned by the Cabinet Office. So I've worked alongside them for the time that we've been using that piece of legislation. And they now cite Somerset as the highest user of the Digital Economy Act. But what it meant for me is that I had a critical friend to work alongside me to help me make sure it was a proper and correct use of that power. And it's been really, really helpful. So the Cabinet Office have been incredibly helpful in the work that we've been doing. So that's kind of the first part around the information governance. Obviously, the relationship building, absolutely critical. And then the final, and obviously, you know, I'd say the backbone to it is your IT architecture, the infrastructure that you have. Because all this relationship work and the data sharing work is absolutely fine. But if you have nowhere for the data to go once you've secured it, in effect, then obviously that will be a problem to you. So you need, in effect, a data warehouse or a data lake that the data can be pulled into before it's matched and merged. So really important. And data engineers, data scientists, our data visualization, our Power BI developers, you know, those roles are like gold dust to the local authority. And we realised that many years ago, actually it was hard to find people with those skills to come and work in Somerset Council. So we started a whole programme of work around apprentices. So we started bringing in apprentices who were doing their sort of Power BI stroke engineering qualifications and bringing them in and supporting them through their apprenticeship and almost growing our own.
It really illustrates the importance of that leadership culture in building those relationships across organisations, building that trust, bringing things together. It's difficult to imagine how you could really progress without that leadership culture being in place and growing and developing as you go through the work. And on your second point there around the importance of having the right expertise to be able to deliver a project like this, I think we... For a long time, we really undervalued our data analysts, but they're really at the heart of what we're doing at the moment, aren't they?
Absolutely are. And I think as well, you know, when we built our other version, Transform Family View, rather than the analysts building it, we actually built it with our service users, our lead professionals, our social workers, because them feeling they're part of the solution is really important. I've seen systems built by analysts and very technical, capable people who it absolutely is not a system that's used because the professionals out on the front line don't feel it fits what they need it to do. And I think that's really important. So I spent 6 months working alongside our social workers, our early help teams and some of our external providers to understand where the frustrations were around that retrieval burden that Josh McAllister, you know, touched on in his report on social care, to really understand those frustrations and then how we can bring that information in, but also how we can visualise it in a way that they understand what it means, because it was really important to me that the system was easy to understand. Some of the technology and the capabilities within our teams are not sort of digitally. So I know we're going to be talking a little bit later on around digital poverty, but actually some of the IT skills of some of our workers are not where we think it might be. So having a system that was easy to use has meant it's more inclusive and therefore we're getting high usage, and therefore it's serving its purpose of providing a practitioner with that single view of a child and family.
Yeah, that relationship between frontline staff and the developers is crucial, isn't it? So we really need to be developing systems that support practice and shape practice and really help with those the overheads of social work. So, you know, reaching out for information and communication. So supporting those things that are essential, but they can be time consuming, they can be clunky if our systems aren't working properly, and they can divert social workers away from really important, more impactful work. So the more that we can build those relationships between developers and social works and really sort of overcome some of those technical challenges that we face in practice, the better.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been available to the practitioners since March last year. And previous to that, we had an old system that was built on old technology, and we had a different view for internal and then a different platform for external. And that was where the challenge was, really. It was trying to keep both systems up to date. So this new system that was built on the back of funding from the Department of Education on the Digital and Data Solutions Fund has been groundbreaking for us to have that team who is dedicated to the build and also the funding to be able to do it. And alongside that, we wrote a guide, a how-to guide for a manager and a data architect around what needs to be considered and some of the learnings, not just from Somerset but from Bristol as well. You know, we worked really closely with Bristol on that program of work, so that's been really helpful for other authorities who are looking at, you know, starting the journey or are maybe stuck in the journey, which is obviously a really difficult place to be in.
So your system has been in place for some time now. So how has the implementation of the single view of the child impacted your work and the outcomes for children and families? Can you share some success stories that you've had along the way?
Yeah, so I think if we just start with the professionals, really. So professionals, especially in our voluntary community sector and our schools, were almost working blind with some families. So referral would come in and they wouldn't understand who else was involved with the family. That was really crucial. Who else is involved? So being able to show a professional who else is involved with the family and their email address and phone numbers. And I was surprised that, you know, professionals were still asking in this day and age for phone numbers, but they felt that they were really important if they were arranging strategy meetings and had to work really quickly for the safeguarding of a child. So we started to pull in phone numbers as well. And that has really helped join up that early help system. And I was contacted by a school a couple of weeks ago who said Access to Transform has absolutely been transformational in me arranging a meeting. I wanted to arrange a team around the family meeting. I'm a parent and family support advisor in a school. I had worries about the child. The head had worries about the child. We knew they were in social housing, but we didn't know who the provider was. And we knew that there were others involved with other members of the family who weren't on roll at school, and we didn't know who they were. And we looked to Transform. All the information was there. I sent an email to everybody, and the next day I was able to arrange a team around the family meeting, inclusive of all the practitioners who needed to be there alongside the family. And that, to me, is amazing, because that would not have happened without Transform Family View. So that was one really good example. And another one is we have an emergency duty team who work out of hours on safeguarding concerns, and they were contacted by the police to say there was an allegation of a kidnap of a child, and the police had attended the address and the family had moved and they had no way of knowing the address. The social care system still had the old address that the police had, they closed the social care, but when they looked on Transform, the new address had been pulled through from the school's information. So they sent the police there and they located the child safe and well within 10 minutes. Just absolutely a couple of really good examples of when a joined up system is really needed to safeguard that child.
And great examples there of connecting people to people and connecting people to information. And I think that's what's really at the heart of these systems, isn't it? It's reducing the amount of work that it takes for busy professionals to actually connect to each other and the information that they need.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, you know, people say, oh, you know, it will stop professional conversations. It absolutely won't. You know, it makes more professional conversations happen because they go to that right professional straight away and have those conversations. People are worried that, you know, it's a decision making tool, and it's absolutely not. It doesn't make decisions. But what it does is it aids you to make a better decision based on facts that you have in front of you. And then you can use the information that the families have given you to layer over that. And you've got then a really rich picture of the difficulties that the family are experiencing. Something else which I hadn't thought too much about, which is coming up now, is data quality and accuracy and assurance in the data that we have in our systems. So because Transform Family View is a read-only system, everything is automated within it and there's no ability to edit anything. So if information comes in on a child with a date of birth that's different to another date of birth for the same child in another system, the system will create two children because it doesn't know not to do that. So what we're able to do then is go back to the data sources and unpick and investigate which is the accurate date of birth, and then reflect and speak to the data source owner for the inaccurate one and have that accurately changed. So when the data comes in for the next refresh, the data is updated. So in effect, it's quality assuring the data that we have in all our systems across the partnership. And again, that's a really good thing for us to be able to do.
So that's a good example of an unexpected benefit of the single view of the child. We probably couldn't have anticipated that that would be the outcome.
No, absolutely not. So then we think about benefits to families. So in Somerset, you know, many years ago, I worked on the Total Place programme, and I was looking at families who were high contact of public services and trying to understand, you know, why they were such high contact. And we had examples of perhaps 18 different organisations working with the family and unpicking why that was. And the families would tell us that they felt they're assessed to death. You know, we're just constantly assessed, and then another agency comes in to support us and we're assessed again. So actually understanding on Transform Family View when an early help assessment has happened and the date and the author of that assessment and their email address means that the link can be made very quickly. The author of the existing EHA can speak to the family, and if the family are happy, that can be shared. And although family circumstances change very quickly, the demographics and the background won't change. So again, that doesn't need to be redone. So that just prevents then the families telling their story over and over again, which is absolutely incredible. I spent some time with young people at a youth forum. So thinking about the ethics of this, it's really important to me that we get it right. So although we have it on our privacy notice and we've published that and we've spoken and we've sent out surveys to parents, I wanted to speak to young people about their thoughts around the work that we're doing. And they said to us, actually, if the school knew that CAMHS were involved with my support, I feel that I might have had a better outcome than the school not knowing. So I feel that was really interesting that even the young people are picking up, you know, a CAMHS health organisation joining up with the school for them to understand that support that's being offered. So I thought that was really important as well. Young people said that they're happy that the information is shared, but they don't want us to use it against them, which is fair enough. And parents who have children who have special educational needs and disabilities, our parent carer forum, they said to me, we're happy for you to share fact, but we don't want you to share judgment. Sometimes if we've got a child with SEND, we feel we're judged. So actually, if you just share fact, you know, that's fine if it's to help and benefit our children. So I thought that was a really interesting way of looking at it as well.
Yeah, and I think there are assumptions from some children and families that we're already sharing information in this way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just on the subject of children and families, how do you integrate the voice of children and families into, firstly, the design of the single view of the child, but also to build on that piece around not having to repeat their own story? I know that you were doing a little bit of thinking around this last time we spoke.
Yeah, we're still doing some thinking around this, actually. And we're also thinking about the protective factors as well, because it tends to show incidents that have happened, missing episodes, you know, involvement with the police. So actually, you know, those protective elements we're perhaps not capturing very well in relation to the voice of the family. So thinking about what those parents said and only sharing facts, obviously it's only the facts that's shared, but we don't share any case notes. So we share enough information for the system to be useful, so data minimization, but we don't share anything that would then go on to become intrusive for families. So more than would be expected. In relation to the thinking about that voice, we haven't really got much further than we are now around that. So we have obviously spoken. We've been out to forums and we've spoken to parents, young people. We've published our privacy notices and we've sent surveys out to many families who've been part of different activities through schools. But that actual sort of voice of the child and then embedding it in the build is not something that we've made much progress on yet, but absolutely something that we're looking at.
Your system is already doing the basics very well. And I know that you're thinking about the direction of travel and building additional pieces to your system. So how do you see the future of single view of the child evolving in the next few years? And how could you integrate emerging technologies such as AI into your platform?
So we've already started looking at targeted risk models, so thinking about the predictive analytics. We were funded by the Careers Enterprise Company about 18 months ago to look at rebuilding the RONI tool. So most local authorities have a risk of knee indicator, which is a very old tool built just basically on whether the status of the child and their attendance levels and suspensions, exclusions. So we wanted to relook at that and think, are there other factors within a child's life where that child has gone on to become an early school leaver or a NEET, as they're often referred to, not an education, employment and training. And actually, if we overlay what we know about the cohort onto our cohort of young people at the moment, could we start to understand who looks likely to go on to become not an education, employment and training? So that started to become really effective in the work that we're doing with our careers leads. So we've built a specific page within that on our Transform Family View, and that page is accessed by careers leads and designated safeguarding leads and some of our pupil referral units heads. So that's really interesting way of looking at it. And now we're looking at exclusions and whether we can lay a similar risk model to young people who are excluded. So that's a big piece of work for our data scientists. We're starting to look at AI and how it can support us with the population of our education healthcare plans. So our EHCPs, there is quite a backlog with the preparation of these plans. So we're starting to work with AI to see whether it can actually build those plans for us. And then we can have the professional basically top and tailing it and making sure it's accurate. That is starting to show really good benefits. And at the moment we outsource this work, so that would be a massive time saving and a cost saving to Somerset as well, if we could look at that, and also a benefit for families because they're waiting such a long time for their assessments. And then if we can obviously speed the process up, that would be really helpful. We're looking at whether we can add in a complex search capability to our digital view, which would pull from our case notes. So we're starting to think about whether we can sort of link up the case management system and the single view like that, which is really important. We're building a criminal justice page. So our social workers and our family intervention workers have told us that even though we give them limited police information, it still doesn't help. It doesn't give them enough. So they need to know more about the situation when there was criminality involved, whether it was the adult or the child. So we're looking at having a page which would include probation data, data from the police, data from our youth justice team, and information on our prevention work and some of our choice of consequences and our courses that we've run for children around prevention, and then start to think about courts and whether we could pull in maybe sort of court orders into that to really give that whole overview of what's going on in relation to criminal justice. So that's a good piece of work at the moment. And I guess the final thing, which has been really helpful for schools at the moment, is we've built a schools dashboard maybe 2.5-3 years ago, and that's piloted in 4 schools. From that, the alerts of police involvement come in overnight to the school. So building that into our Transform Family View as a page specifically for our designated safeguarding leads and our heads would reduce the need for the op encompass notification domestic alerts to go backwards and forwards and sometimes not come in a timely way. What we absolutely want is if something happens to a young person of an evening, we want the school to know about it in the morning when that young person comes in, so they're ready to offer them support. So it can be wrapped around them at the appropriate time. So that'll be a really good piece of work when we build that.
Yeah, so I think with predictive analytics, there's a lot of interest in it, but there's a lot of hesitance as well, isn't there? I think early projects with predictive analytics, they ventured a little bit more into the decision-making processes than I think people were really comfortable with. And they had very poor predictive capabilities. There was a whole raft of ethical concerns that arose from that. But what I've noticed is that local authorities are tending to go towards the predictive capabilities where there's no decision making. It operates at an alert system. It's at that bottom end of the continuum where there isn't really any automation or decision making capabilities or any of those sorts of things. And there's a human in the loop. There's a human sitting there looking at the information. That person has been flagged possibly sooner than they would otherwise have been. And then a human is actually taking action and taking steps. And you mentioned earlier that there are some myths associated with developing a single view of the child, and likewise with some of the emerging technologies as well. And the example that you gave was around single view of the child making decisions, which we know that it's not doing. What are some other myths that you've come across in the work that you've been doing, whether that's with professionals or with children and families, that we can debunk?
Yeah, I think one of the myths is around if you have this, professionals won't talk to each other. Mm-hmm. And so that's obviously the first one. And it absolutely, you know, has been proven, you know, across the system already to get those professionals talking. I was quite surprised by that one. I didn't think that would be something that would have sort of come out, but it absolutely has. We've obviously talked about the decision making, the data accuracy. You know, how can you absolutely do all this and pull all this in an automated way without any manual uploads and actually be accurate? You know, we don't trust what the data says. So what we've had to do to overcome that is we've had to put a tooltip over the data. So where you see the data in the system, you hover over it and the tooltip tells you where the data came from, when it was last updated, how often it comes into the system to assure the practitioner that the data they're seeing is accurate. We also do audits now. We do monthly audits on the system. So we audit an internal professionals using it, or for external professionals, but then also the data it holds in the system. So then I look at a young person, and if I know they've got a CAMHS involvement, or they're, you know, supported by the voluntary community sector, or they've had a number of exclusions, that's checked as well. And at the same time, we also, if it's in relation to a school, check their privacy notice that they are publishing the facts that they do share information with the partnership in relation to Transform Family View and the explanation around that. So how can you join all this information up without consent? And people will still talk to me about that and say, you know, do you write to the families and tell them that you're doing this work? And the answer is no, we do this work using our public task legal basis for the purposes of safeguarding. We engage with the family, we explain to them what we're doing, we gain their cooperation, but we don't ask for their consent. And then I go on to talk about how consent needs to be, you know, explicit and freely given. So we've done a big piece of work with the Somerset Safeguarding Partnership around the use of consent and the use of public task, and how we need to start with the right legal basis to start with the work that we're doing with families.
Mm. And that information governance piece that you do at the start, that's quite a detailed piece of work, isn't it? So the process is, perhaps you can describe the process for us, Jill. Just talk us through what that information governance process looks like at the beginning. How do you decide what is proportionate and necessary? And what purposeful limitations do you place on the data that you decide to share?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So the very start of any of the data sharing is the data protection impact assessment. So it identifies what the sharing is and the risks involved with it and what we can do to mitigate those risks. And then we do that for internally at Somerset Council. And then the partner who we're looking at sharing with will also do a DPIA, as they're known. What we've been started to do now is we've got a colleague working in the NHS IG Central Self-Commissioning Unit. She's doing a template for us for a DPIA, because lots of local authorities are having to write them. So actually, if we had one template we can just populate, it would be really helpful to give us information around the things we need to be considering when we're looking at those risks and mitigation. So once the DPIA has been agreed from ourselves, we then usually share it with the partner who we're looking to share data with. They then use it to in effect write their own DPIA. Once we've got our data protection impact assessments, we look at them and we work alongside our data protection officer to understand whether it's proportionate and relevant, and actually the risks, the mitigations we're putting in, will outweigh those risks, and actually it's, you know, for the right purpose. Alongside all that, we're looking at the legal gateways, because you need a legal gateway to be able to share this information. So what are those legal gateways? And obviously around safeguarding of children, we have the public task legal basis. And then you start to think about the Data Protection Act, and actually you following all the guidance within the Data Protection Act. So you make sure you've got everything in place. And once you're in place with all that, you can then start to think about what information it is that you need to be pulling into the system to be useful, but not so much to be intrusive. And I think that was the parts that you were talking about then, and you referred to the how do we work out what we need? And it's a really tricky. So often we use our service requirements that we've done through our work with our practitioners. I look at user stories that people have sent me. You know, it's really good, but wouldn't it be great if it could be doing this? And they identify the rationale around why it would be useful to have certain types of information. Going back to obviously the data owners and then to the professionals. And a good example of that is probation. So probation are currently accessing Transform Family View, but some of the information isn't detailed enough for them, such as they need to know things like when a case closed to social care and why it closed, what the rationale was around the closure. But none of the other partners have the need to see that information. So it's a very fine line between what information you show to which partner, and that's where the role-based profile will be really useful and really helpful. And once we have all that in place, we can then start to think about how the information will come across and the security around sending that information. Obviously, the most secure way is through secure file transfer tunnels, but they have to be built between our organisations. So huge amounts of work that need to happen. And then the other, I guess, once you have the data sharing agreement in place and the data protection impact, and you've agreed how the sharing is going to come in, how do you help professionals understand around the data sharing? Because it's all right having these documents, but professionals on the ground need to understand. So if it's 12 o'clock at night and our social workers in A&E with a family and a nurse comes and they need to talk, you know, how do they understand that they have got the ability to talk about those individuals and that governance is wrapped around them?
There's a lot of moving parts in there, isn't there? So there's there's quite a journey to go on to develop a single view of the child. So you've talked so far about that leadership culture. You've talked about building it's the technical systems that you need to build. There are challenges there to overcome in terms of bringing that information together into a data lake and making it accessible for people. But what you've described is that you don't want to offer too much information, because you don't want to be in a situation where you're limiting the conversations that people then follow up with. So there's kind of a balance to be struck there, isn't there? There's what's legal and what's necessary to share, but also putting those purposeful limitations in there. So you're still encouraging that professional relationship and enabling people to find a starting point to make a connection. Digital poverty affects millions of people in the UK, and this affects children and families and professionals. And this looks different for different people. So this could be a lack of connectivity to the internet. It could be a lack of access to devices. It could be IT systems are out of date and a little bit clunky. It also could relate to digital skills and confidence in participating in online life. Now, there are a lot of negative outcomes that arise from digital poverty. What issues have you seen with digital poverty as you've worked on your project, and what needs to happen to ensure that we can adopt these technologies that enable more efficiency more widely in the social care sector?
It's interesting that you asked that question. It's a real problem in Somerset. We have lots of areas of rural isolation with very limited digital capabilities. And in spite of us, you know, living in 2024, there are still huge areas of Somerset where we can't get any connection to anything. And that does cause a problem, not just for the families who are trying to manage and live in those areas, but our professionals who are working within them as well. You know, we're trying to have a culture now where they come back to the office for limited time. time, and they do lots of their admin work, as it want, with the families, you know, and they work alongside them with their systems. So that really does have a problem. And I touched on it earlier as well, is that the technical capabilities of some of our staff, you know, they didn't join to be technically wizards. They joined to work with children and families. So some of their technical skills are not of a standard where they can use systems that are too complicated. Now, to help us with that, we have managed to build contextual launch buttons in our systems so they can go into all the systems without, in effect, feeling like they're within one. So an example of that is we've built an LCS and an EHM button, which is our children's social care system through Liquid Logic System C, into Transform. So if they're on the child's system, sorry, the child's record in Transform Family View, they can go straight into the child's record in LCS or EHM if they've got permissions. And similarly, we have CIDR in Somerset, which is our Somerset Integrated Digital Electronic Records, which is our joined up health records. And we have a launch button in Transform Family View for that as well. So a social worker can go into their own system from Transform or into the joined up digital health record of a child to self-serve their own health data requirements for that child. And once they're in LCS or EHM, we have a button going back to Transform. So this has helped, and this button's only been in place for a couple of weeks now, but already we've seen a significant increase in the usage because they haven't had to find the Transform Family View app. In effect, they can just go into it through their systems. So that's one way we've understood that the technology capabilities are quite limited from some of our teams, and actually enabled something to be done, a solution for that, to prevent them having to go into different systems. So that's been really helpful. I think what needs to be done, it's a very good question. I don't know the answer, Sarah. I don't know what else we can do in Somerset to help our families become more connect and their digital devices to work. I don't know the answer to that.
I mean, to me, it feels like something that individual local authorities can't really resolve on their own. I think largely it's a big infrastructure issue, isn't it? Thinking about it at a national level rather than the local level for the connectivity piece.
Absolutely. Yeah. I know that our libraries obviously have Wi-Fi and computers available for our families to use, so that's really helpful. But again, being so rural in Somerset, 250 square miles, actually public transport was also a problem. So it's great having the access in the libraries that they can use, but how do they get to the libraries? You know, so that's another problem in itself. So it's a real problem for Somerset, for our families, for our children, for our parents, and for our professionals as well.
And I wonder what it's going to mean with AI emerging at the pace that it's emerging now. It feels a little bit like there's an equalities issue that is starting to emerge. I think digital poverty is already an equalities issue, but with people being unable to share in the benefits of AI and what that can do in terms of day-to-day life, being able to sort of really share the benefits of AI means that I think that we do need to address the digital poverty issue, because we are going to see a widening inequalities gap.
Absolutely.
And it will start to affect people's education, employment, mm-hmm. and opportunities in life more widely, I think. We're doing a separate piece on AI at the moment, Jill, just as an aside from this.
Yeah, no, that's that.
Yeah. Which has been fascinating, by the way.
Yeah, I bet it has.
Yeah, I'm so excited about it. I've started blogging about AI.
That's amazing.
So let's focus in a little bit on the work that Somerset is doing with DfE and 12 local authorities. So Somerset has recently been awarded a DfE grant to work with 12 local authorities to evaluate their readiness to implement a single digital view of the child. Tell us a little bit about that work.
Yes, so this work's followed on from some other pieces of work, and I've already touched on the information governance work and the NHS colleague who's helped us with that work around the data protection impact assessment template she's pulling together, because we were given a grant a couple of years ago to write an information sharing data toolkit and template around tier two. We worked alongside the DfE for that piece of work and the NHS, and actually we've been able to publish that and really help some of our local authority colleagues improve their robustness of their data sharing arrangements across their partnerships. So that was really helpful. And then following on from that, we actually gave support to 9 safeguarding partnerships along to the development of their tier ones, where we were looking at those safeguarding partners, so the police, the local authority and health coming together for those safeguarding arrangements. So following on then from that and the work that we were doing around our transformed family view, our single view of a child, the DfE realised that there was a gap in some local authorities' ability to build such a product. And we really wanted to enable some effective support to those local authorities so they could take from the starting place where they are to that place where they could actually then build the view. So it's basically some gap analysis work. So because we've got such limited time between now and the end of March, we really felt that we could only work with 12 local authorities. So we looked for 6 local authorities who were of a low maturity in relation to their data culture and 6 who were more mature. We put out an expression of interest. We circulated that nationally and we had a huge response. And people really understood that we weren't going to build their system for them. But actually what we could do is look at their current position and their goal. And then we could look at what needed to be done to get from one place to the other using the learnings from Bristol and from Somerset and our how-to guides and all the work that we've done to really help them. So we're doing the gap analysis. We're gathering it through interviews, really, with key people within the local authority. So that's obviously the project lead for the Single Universal Child View. The DCS, so the Director of Children's Services, the Early Help Head of Service, the IG Manager and the Digital Data Lead. So interviewing those key people within their organisation, understand their views, where they need to go, where they need to get there, help them with some workshops and some sort of strategic conversations if they're stuck, and then put together a report at the end explaining really the steps they need to take to get them into that place. Alongside that, this is the most advantageous piece of it, will be the work alongside us to get from that position now to that scoping report at the end. They will have the benefit of us working alongside them and going to their workshops and their strategic meetings. So it's really good offer. You know, it's obviously free for the local authorities and funded by that grant from the DfE.
Sounds like interesting work. What key factors do you consider when you're assessing a local authority's readiness to implement a single digital view of the child?
So, I mean, many of those things that I've spoken about already. So do they have the infrastructure to receive information data? So a data lake or a data warehouse? What are their information governance arrangements? What are their relationships with their partners like? Are they receiving police data from the DWP? So understanding all of that. Thinking about their experience in their current team to build the infrastructure, the pipeline, so whether they've got capacity in their data engineering team, even if they have data engineers at all. And support from the senior leaders, and we've talked again, you know, about that, but that's just so important. You know, is there buy-in from the senior leadership team that this work will happen? You know, is there a proper project initiation document? Is it embedded in their transformation plans? So those are some of the areas that are considered. And then any user requirement work, have they even considered working alongside the end users? Because many of them will not have thought about that and will again be thinking about a product built by a BI developer that then just goes into the service. So that's really interesting, picking on that as well, because as we talked about that, you know, no front end should ever be built without, you know, that feedback and that buy-in from the practitioner.
And so the project is in its early days, but what have you learned so far about local authorities' readiness?
Some areas are very mature and actually just need minimal support to get them over that final push to be able to sort of release a product. Some have got very huge data teams, you know, sort of 20 plus within in their data teams, which is surprising. Others think that they are very close, but actually when we unpick it and we talk through, especially around the ethics and the actual development of the front end, realise that they might be not be quite as close as they thought. And some are a very long way off and actually want our support to help them tell that story to their strategic lead so it can really be seen as the way forward.
Thanks for listening to this Research in Practice podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it. Why not share with your colleagues and let us know your thoughts on Twitter? Tweet us at ResearchIP.